I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The music you're listening to is Tempest Fantasy, composed by Paul Moravec and performed by Trio Solisti. This is the first movement named for Ariel, the mischievous and magical character in Shakespeare's The Tempest. The music won the 2004 Pulitzer Prize. Paul Moravec is one of the composers taking American classical music back to that realm of music that is meant to be memorable. Some critics sniff that it may not be academic enough or challenging enough for the listeners, but Moravec's career suggests otherwise. His music is now being performed across the country, showing that there is a real hunger for music that shifts modern American composition away from the minimalists and the atonal sound. Well, where are you on this? Are you wary of new classical music, afraid that it's going to be too hard to enjoy? Or do you think new music, any music, should require some work on the part of the listener? If your local orchestra is playing and it's not Beethoven or Brahms, but rather a name you've never heard, will you go? Will you buy a ticket? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The composer Paul Moravec is joining us from a studio in where else but Carnegie Hall, New York. Paul, nice of you to be with us.
Thanks, Dick. Great to be here.
A little bit late, if you don't mind, but congratulations on the Pulitzer Prize.
Well, thank you. Never too late.
No, okay. It seems to have made a difference. I was looking at your sort of list of engagements. I see you in Colorado and California and Cooperstown in the summertime. Have you noticed?
Yes, there's been a big change in my career and the level of activity. I'm quite busy and happily so. Sometimes I think too busy, so be careful what you wish for.
In fact, you're going to be premiering a piece in Carnegie Hall, or a piece of yours is being premiered in Carnegie Hall tonight.
Yes, amazingly. What a coincidence. This is a wonderful pianist named Tony DeMar, and he's playing at Zankel Hall, which is the fabulous new addition to the Carnegie complex. And he's playing a varied concert of works by composers from Broadway, jazz, and classical music. So it's quite a spread.
I want to go back to something that I mentioned in the introduction about the connection between Shakespeare and the Tempest fantasy, because I'm curious to know how a play so rich in language ends up as inspiration for a piece of music without lyrics.
Well, the Tempest itself is immensely complex, and we could talk about it for hours and days and months, but one thing I can focus on is its musical nature. It is very musical, and in a sense, it's about music. People keep commenting on music. There are several songs that Ariel in particular sings, mm-hmm. and it's about the power of the imagination. Prospero, in a way, is an artist. And there are many commentators, and I agree with this, that Shakespeare identified with Prospero as a creative artist. And so I also identify with Prospero. He's able to conjure up these magical dreams and that spring from his imagination, and he has Ariel make them real. And I see it as a metaphor, for example, for the relationship between the composer and the performer. Prospero is the composer who imagines these dreams but can't actually realize them, and then the performer is Ariel, who carries them out, who actually performs them and makes these dreams literally come true.
There's a speech by another of Prospero's servants, Caliban. I think mm-hmm. it comes in the third act, which was a part of the direct inspiration for this. I'm wondering if I can get you to read the lines that sure. caught your attention, and then we'll listen to the music that came from that. Can we do that?
Sure. This is one of the most beautiful speeches, in my view, of all of Shakespeare, and it's so Shakespeare, paradoxically, to give this speech to this misshapen monster shortly after he's just plotted to kill Prospero, in fact. And he comes out with this beautiful speech about the nature of this island and how musical it is, this enchanted island. He says, "Be not afeard, the isle is full of noises, sounds, and sweet airs that give delight and hurt not. Sometimes a thousand twangling instruments will hum about mine ears, and sometimes voices that, if I then had waked after long sleep, will make me sleep again. And then in dreaming, the clouds methought would open and show riches ready to drop upon me, that when I waked, I cried to dream again.
That's just a little bit of Sweet Airs. It is the fourth movement in The Tempest Fantasy, written by Paul Moravec. It was the piece of music that got him the 2004 Pulitzer Prize. And I have to tell you, Paul, listening to just you read and the music begin at the end, I got this huge shiver up my spine. I don't know whether or not the music still affects you that way.
Sure. I enjoy it every time I listen to it. By the way, Vladimir Nabokov said that a work of art is felt in the spine primarily, and I agree with that. I think that that's okay. Where you feel it most deeply.
Well, then this one works. Went straight to my spine.
Good.
I'm interested in also hearing just a little bit from you about the other side of Tempest. Again, it's something I mentioned at the beginning of the program. You had some treatment for mental illness back in the 1990s, and I note from reading about what you've been up to since then that it's one of these things where you actually look forward to opportunities to talk about that for people.
Well, this is a rather recent phenomenon, which has to do with my celebrity of winning the Pulitzer Prize. It makes a composer a public figure in a way that he isn't before the prize. And I was asked by this terrific group called A Beautiful Night in the Bay Area of, San Francisco in the Bay Area, and they have asked me to do a fundraiser for them. And it's going to be on March 19th. It's called A Beautiful Night. And we're raising money to create a working farm for adolescents, young people recovering from severe mental illness. Now, I've agreed to do this because I would like to do what I can to help people suffering from the terrible disease of mental illness when it's quite severe and out of control, and also to help to remove societal stigmas which are attached to mental illness.
The depression that you had, Paul, was it such that you couldn't work when you were in these moments of depression?
Depression is something of a misnomer, and I refer to a book by William Styron called Darkness Visible, where he nails it right on the head. Darkness Visible is an account of Styron's own experience with clinical depression. And he says depression is the wrong word. It's a wimpy word. It doesn't explain really what's going on, because depression is not, I'm feeling kind of down and I can't get out of bed. You know, we all have depression. We all have bad days and so on. That's not what clinical depression is. It is, as Styron says, it is a howling tempest in the brain. It is, I've never seen an actual hurricane, but I've seen pictures of movies of hurricanes blowing houses over, cars tumbling down the street and so on. That gives you some idea of what clinical depression is like. It is an out-of-control storm. Which drives people to suicide because it makes existence itself unbearable, and there's only one way out.
Well, how are you doing? You had some electroshock treatment in the mid-90s. Do you regard yourself as someone who's been cured, or what do you say?
Well, you might ask my friends about that, but yes, I electroshock therapy, electroshock treatment probably saved my life. Yes, it worked. And knock wood, there's no wood around here, but knock wood, it's. Yes.
Did it have any effect, your period with depression, did it have any effect on your work as a composer?
Well, it focuses one's imagination once one recovers. And I think that in dealing with the Tempest, for example, I'm dealing with a character, Prospero, whose emotional trajectory from the beginning of the play to the end is one from melancholy to joy,
right,
and triumph. It's from defeat to triumph. He has a kind of apotheosis at the end. And that has something to do with my own experience, because when one recovers, if one recovers, it is really quite something.
Paul Moravec is with us this hour. He's the composer of the music that you're listening to right now, The Tempest Fantasy. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. It's not just the Pulitzer Prize. It's also this man's talent and the work that he has produced that has orchestras right across the country, chamber and otherwise, playing his music. We'd like to know what you think of modern American composition and whether or not this is the kind of music that's going to move it back onto the stage and out of the classroom. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection in this hour, a conversation with Paul Moravec, winner of the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for his work, The Tempest Fantasy. He's joining us from a studio at Carnegie Hall. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And given that we're talking about modern American composition, we thought we'd have Terry Teachout spend a little bit of time with us this hour. He's joining us on the line from New York. Terry's the music critic for Commentary. That's a monthly opinion magazine. Drama critic for the Wall Street Journal. He's been with us before on the program. He happened also to write the liner notes for Tempest Fantasy, released on CD last month. And Terry, it's nice to have you back on the program.
Yes, it's good to be here. Thanks.
Can I ask you, in your judgment as a critic, what it is about Paul's music that's distinctive, that makes it stand out? Because I know you've been listening to him for a long time.
Yes, I first heard Paul's music 10 years ago. I heard a performance of his violin sonata. And it was one of those experiences where you hear something and it grabs you. By the spine, by the heart, I'm not sure particularly what body part it was, but whatever it was, I knew immediately that I was hearing a voice that was at the same time deeply rooted in tradition and entirely personal and contemporary and immediate. And when you hear music like that, you want to know who did it and you want to know something about them. And I actually called him up and asked, "Who are you?" And that's how we got to know each other.
And what did he say?
I can't remember what he said, actually.
Do you remember, Paul?
Well, we've been talking about it for the last 10 years. That's what we've been saying.
That's true. That's true. It's been a long conversation ever since then.
Very long.
Paul, to be continued.
Yeah, Paul is that great rarity. He's a composer with a really philosophical turn of mind. He doesn't just put notes on paper, but he thinks deeply about what he's up to and what it means. And for a person who lives in the world of words as I do, it's an amazingly illuminating experience to be able to talk about nonverbal matters with a person who's so deeply verbally gifted.
Let's, if we can, talk a little bit, and Paul, I want you in on this one as well.
Sure.
In terms of where the music fits in American composition today, because I don't think I'm wrong to say that there's a kind of resistance there, and maybe a resistance that's been built up over too many years with too many compositions or composers that are really hard to listen to. Terry, is that a reasonable reaction to new music today?
It is, and it goes back a long way. Really, the sea change happened in the 50s. Before that time, modern classical music in America and in Europe as well, it had two strains. One was an ugly experimental strain, but the other was the kind of fully accessible, open, attractive modern music that we think of when we think of people like Copland or Prokofiev or Benjamin Britten, the middle period Stravinsky. These were composers that made sense to listeners. And just as they were starting to get a purchase on the listening audience, a new generation of late modernists came along who weren't interested in direct communication with audiences. And in the mid-50s, they started to prevail in America, partly because they were sheltered by the academy. Many of them were academics. And as that music began to be played and began to be recorded and eventually developed a kind of a monopoly position in American music, ordinary listeners would come to concert halls and hear this and say, if this be modern music, let us make the least of it. They simply didn't want to hear it. That's how new music got a bad name. And it kept that bad name really until the minimalists came along in the 70s and sort of swept away the rubbish of late modernism with a style that was simple, too simple, I think,
right. But
also accessible and rooted in tonality, the thing that Paul and composers like him have reengaged with after this long period of atonal dominance.
Was it, Paul, your idea that you wanted to make music that was different from what you were hearing and what else was being produced?
Yes, I just want to pick up on something that Terry said first. He referred to academics and so on, and I'm an academic. I'm proudly a member of the Adelphi University faculty.
Head of the music department, are you not?
Absolutely. So I'm very pleased to be a teacher, and that's it's a very important part of my life. And I see the problem that Terry. I agree with Terry to a large extent. I see the problem in terms of memorability. It's a cognitive problem with a lot of music from written about, as he says, from the 1950s on. It has to do with the fact that with certain pieces of music from that time, not only can you not remember the piece when it's over, but you cannot remember it as it's going along, meaning that you cannot construct over time, because that's the medium of time, it only goes in one direction, you cannot construct a coherent narrative structure out of it. You can't connect things as they go along. So an important aspect of what I and my friends are doing, now is to try to bring memorability back into music. And we are taking tonal conventions and redefining them, reinventing them, extending them, and so on.
I'll tell you a story about my predecessor at Commentary, Samuel Lipman, was also a classical pianist as well as a music critic, and he played the second or third performance of Elliot Carter's Piano Concerto. And a few years later...
Elliot Carter being one of these atonal composers.
Yeah, right, one of the late modernists. A few years later, another orchestra called him up. They had the piece on a program, and the soloist had canceled, and they knew that Sam had played it, and asked him if he could come in and perform it. And he sat down at the piano and realized that every note of this concerto that he had worked so hard to learn only a few years before had disappeared from his memory. It was lost.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation this hour. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Julie's on the line. Hi, Julie.
Hi there. I just wanted to give you a younger layman's perspective of, I guess, the resistance to contemporary classical music. And I don't mean to collectively categorize classical music with other types of music, but from my perspective as a younger person, music today just lacks all authenticity. And for that purpose...
When you say music today, Julie, do you mean classical music or do you mean all music?
I think I mean all music, and I'm not very well educated in contemporary classical music, I'll admit that. So I don't mean to disparage anyone's current works or anything, but I just feel like pop music, rock and roll, all of today's music is so monotonous and unoriginal, and that is why, for me, the classical music, not to be redundant, is so special, because it's somehow unique, and that's, for me, my reasoning for being a little skeptical of the contemporary classical movement, I guess. And again, this is very much a layman's perspective. I'm young, and I'm not very well educated in terms of classical music, but that's my two cents on the resistance.
Paul, what do you think?
Well, I think that our caller is referring perhaps to the entertainment industry. And I think there's a distinction between the entertainment industry and the arts. And I think it's a distinction that needs to be pointed out from time to time. People need to be reminded of it. I, as a composer, I'm not an entertainer. I am an artist, and I'm not a part of the entertainment industry per se. And as to authenticity, I can't speak about the entertainment industry, but as an artist, that's certainly very much what I'm concerned with, is about being authentic, being true to myself. It's saying what I mean and meaning what I say. And I think that that's, you know, it's perhaps more likely to happen in the arts than in, you know, the commercial mass 24 hours a day entertainment industry where, you know, where there are other, lots of other agendas at stake.
I don't quite get the distinction here, because I think of a group like the Beatles, right? They composed a lot of music, which I think
is... faves.
Okay,
yes.
It's memorable, right? I mean, that
yes.
It passes the memory test.
Yeah.
It's entertainment, but it's... I mean, their stuff is art too, right?
Oh, absolutely. The Beatles are an exception to the rule that I'm talking about. This is a huge conversation to get into, but let's just talk about the Beatles in particular. I mean, they were... very great entertainers, and they're very great artists at the same time. They wrote some bad songs, let's face it, but their best work is extremely elegant. It's quite intelligent. I'm still astounded when I hear a song like Eleanor Rigby that I think is, you know, I could talk about this for some time. It's just a remarkable achievement intellectually and aesthetically and musically and so on. But this is a rare occasion. And basically, they were part of a time. This is 40 years ago, 50 years ago, where there wasn't such a great divide between the entertainment industry and what's going on in the arts. There was a confluence at that time between highbrow and lowbrow, resulting in something you might call middlebrow. Like West Side Story is a mm-hmm. very, very great work of art and extremely entertaining. It works on both levels.
Terry, let's hear from you on this.
Well, I think that in the time that Paul talks about, that I've written about, one could indeed be an artist and an entertainer, and you can do that now, too. But the difference is that now the entertainment industry, which is what Paul is talking about, is a great kind of industrial complex that's devoted to creating commodities specifically crafted for the purpose of appealing to the largest possible number of people. And the question of individuality really just doesn't enter into it any more in Hollywood than it does in a composer's studio. People like this are simply in a different kind of business. I'm in the middle of writing a biography of Louis Armstrong, who was the quintessential artist-entertainer, a man who thought of himself as both things simultaneously and was both things. And he lived in a time when, as Paul says, there was a real confluence of these two functions. And it's not to say that it's not possible for that to happen now. I mean, there's a lot of entertaining art, and there are a lot of entertainers who do make art, but to be involved in this kind of industrialization of the entertainment process is to be doing something that I think fundamentally militates against the possibility of making art.
Let's take a call from Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Janet's on the line. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I heard one of a concert of Paul's music in New York City, and the musicians compared him to Brahms. And I'd like to know what kind of qualities about Paul's music might be similar to Brahms and why he thinks they might have made that comparison. It was the Trio Celesti after a
sure.
concert at the Morgan Library.
Right. Well, I'm considerably leaner than Brahms, I like to think.
Piano parts are really hard. Maybe that was it.
Right. Brahms has a tremendous sense of structure and harmonic control and lyric. He has an endless gift for melody and so on. I consider these attributes to be the soul of music, and I'm flattered when people compare me to Brahms. He's an ideal of mine.
Janet, would you make that comparison as well, or are you just curious about the connection there?
I would make that comparison, but I'm glad to hear from the composer himself.
You're very kind. Thank you.
When you are writing music, are you writing it to please your ear? Are you writing it to challenge your ear? What's your test, Paul, of something? I know you rewrite a lot, but what's your test of I'm getting somewhere with this?
I write to please myself and challenge myself. Principally, I do not write for myself as a composer. I do not write for myself as a specialist. Technique is a specialist's concern, and that goes without saying. I'm going to write the best piece I can using the best tools that I can, as expertly as I can. Okay, that's a given. But what am I writing for? I'm writing for myself as a listener. I'm writing for myself, I write for myself something that I would love to hear. In other words, if I'm writing a piece for a concert premiere, I think, okay, I'm going to put down $30 or whatever. I'm going to go in and going to sit down. Curtain goes up or whatever. Musicians come out on stage. What are they going to play? I want to be amazed. I want to be astounded. I want to love it. And that's what I try to write. And so if I, in my private audience of just me in a studio, if I impress myself on that level, then I think that I'm getting somewhere.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina for a call from Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. How are you?
Well, thanks for calling.
I am Robert Weiss's assistant at Carolina Ballet
in
Raleigh, North Carolina. And
hello,
I know
Elizabeth.
Terry Teachout very well. How are you, Terry?
It's good to hear from you.
And we're very excited about Ricky doing a new ballet to Paul's Tempest Fantasy next year. So I just wanted to get that out on the airwaves and to let him know that we're really
terrific.
Looking forward to this opportunity.
I thought from the first time I ever heard Paul's music that he was an absolute natural for ballet, and I'm so excited that this is going to happen.
Well, it's going to be a Shakespeare evening. As you know, we're going to be doing José Limón's The Moor's Pavane, and then this new piece, a premiere, A Tempest Fantasy. So it's
has it been choreographed yet, Elizabeth?
It has not been choreographed. We're still working on this season, but they are working on concepts for the costumes and the scenery, and thinking that this might be a wonderful piece to take on the road.
Let me go back to Terry here, because you said that you thought this was good for ballet. Why? What was it that you heard in it that made you think, dancers, we need to be up on stage while this is being played?
Well, there are several things about Paul's music that make me feel that way. One is the sense of rhythmic propulsion. I mean, Paul was compared to Brahms a little while ago, but I think of him much more as really a quintessentially American composer whose music is full of the, in a way, the same kind of rhythmic immediacy in life that you hear in jazz and other musics like that, and also in the music of someone like Stravinsky, who was the dance composer par excellence. His music also makes sense to the ear in a structural way. It's not this amorphous mass of sound that comes at you like a cloud. It's something that you can hear the order in it. And that's something to which choreographers immediately respond, because it's what they pick up on in music that gives them the inspiration to put steps in order and action in order. I've never doubted for a second that if Paul got the opportunity, he'd write a great full evening ballet score, and maybe that'll happen one of these days.
I hope so, yeah.
Is it in your mind, Paul?
Sure.
Big undertaking, though, isn't it?
Sure, but, I'm a consenting adult.
Terry, I want to thank you for taking a few moments to join us on the program. It's nice to hear from you again.
It's good to be here.
Terry Teachout, music critic of Commentary and drama critic for the Wall Street Journal. His latest book is All in the Dances, A Brief Life of George Balanchine, and one coming out, as he mentioned, on Louis Armstrong. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation this hour with Paul Moravec as we talk about modern American composition. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection. My name is Dick Gordon. My guest this hour is Paul Moravec. He is head of the music department at Adelphi University. That makes him an academic, but he's also a composer. He won the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for Tempest Fantasy. It's a chamber work written for piano, violin, cello, and clarinet. In fact, his latest work, The Isle of Manhattoes, is debuting tonight as part of Anthony DeMar's solo piano recital at Carnegie Hall. And Paul's joining us from a studio at Carnegie Hall. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Greensboro, North Carolina. Mark's on the line. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I haven't heard Paul's music, but I have to say that I echo the earlier caller who's, I think modern classical music is dreadful. I had occasion to listen to Fanfare for the Uncommon Woman a couple of years ago and thought it was just an abysmal piece. And frankly, I don't listen much anything that was composed after 1910. I like Rodrigo, I like Bach, I like Vivaldi, I like Beethoven, but classical music just doesn't do anything for me.
Modern classical music doesn't do anything for you.
Yeah, modern classical music. Help me out here.
No, you know what? I want you to help me out. What is it about it that has made you change your, or, you know, sort of make up your mind that you're not going to lay out the $30 for a ticket to go and listen to something that's new? Was it one piece, two pieces, like a whole lifetime of listening to stuff that you don't like? What?
It's a couple years of listening to the Greenberg Symphony do it occasionally, and I don't like the atonal qualities. I don't like the sometimes the unusual percussion, jerky rhythms. It just doesn't. I find it very unpleasing to listen to. And I haven't listened to Paul's work, so I don't know. I can't put his in comparison.
Well, hang on. Let's do that just now. We've got another of the movements of Tempest Fantasy, and we're going to put you in the critic's chair for a couple of moments. You got a minute, don't you, Mark?
Yeah.
Okay. This is, I think, the third movement of the Tempest Fantasy. We're only going to listen to a little bit of it, but I'm going to look for a review when we come back. Okay, Mark, put pencils down now. What do you think?
Frankly, it's just not very I don't find it very pleasing to the ear.
What are you looking for then?
Well, I'm not musically trained. I couldn't discern a melody of any particular consequence. I just didn't relate to it in any way.
It's a little bit like an SAT where you only get a short moment to listen to this. Yeah, Paul,
can
jump
I
in
interject here? I think it's a little unfair just to take a little snippet and you know.
It's completely unfair.
It's completely unfair.
My suggestion to you, sir, is to if I might make a plug for the CD, which is available on Arabesque Records, buy the CD on Amazon or at your local store. Have a listen. And listen to the whole CD. It's 60 minutes, actually. It's not just this one piece. And then make up your mind. I should point out that the section that Dick happened to select is deliberately ugly. It's about Caliban. I mean, it's deliberately monstrous.
Okay.
So I would say it's a little bit unfair to do this little soundbite like that.
And the last name is Paul? Paul what?
Paul Moravec. Yeah.
Moravec. I will do what you suggest, sir.
You can find a link to Paul's website and more information about Paul on our website. We are at theconnection.org. Okay, Mark?
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks
nice
very
have
much.
You, have your call. Tell me, though, Paul, when you hear people go, "Oh, it's all dreck, I don't want it," to listen to it. It does require saying, you know what? You need to give it a little bit of time.
Well, what happens, this is a function of human nature, that perceptions lag behind changes in reality. And the reality is that contemporary music has changed in the last 10, 15, 20 years. It has become more accessible. I'm part of a younger generation of composers, and I will include older composers as well, like John Creoliano and John Adams and so on, Steve Reich, who have been writing music which speaks directly and compellingly and beautifully to audiences. But audiences are gun-shy because of the sort of vestigial trauma of so many of their experiences from 1950 on and so on. So my advice is to give it a chance. The 20th century is over. We're in a new era now. And it would be great if people would respond to what I consider anyways a changed reality. And I consider this actually a golden age for American music. The standards for composition are higher than they've ever been. The standards for performance among performing artists is higher than it's ever been. And we have financial problems, you know, in the arts, and we're all aware of those. But otherwise, in terms of ability and talent and originality and productivity, this is a wonderfully golden era.
Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky for our next call. Matthew is joining us from there. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you doing today?
Very well. Thanks for calling.
I'm a member of the Louisville Orchestra, and we record a lot of modern music over the years. In fact,
good
we're
for you.
Famous
you're,
for that.
You're the best, yeah.
What do you play, Matthew?
I play bassoon in the orchestra. And we do record an awful lot of ugly music, I must say. But there are a lot of beautiful works coming out. In fact, you just mentioned John Corigliano, of which we just recently played a group of pieces from the movie The Red Violin. And
sure.
A lot of people were very moved by the music in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other fine composers that we hear and that we record and perform. A lot of it, though, is truly ugly, and I understand why audiences are afraid of it.
Do you think that page is turning at all, Matthew, in the way that Paul was describing it?
I think that composers are realizing that they have to write accessible music because the audience just really turns up its nose at anything that's atonal, and rightfully so. I mean, our lives are very complicated, and it's nice to go to the concert hall and relax and enjoy something that takes you away from that. You know, and a lot of the prizes, the Grammeier Prize is located here in Louisville, and a lot of those winning pieces are often Holocaust pieces. I mean, mm-hmm. they're very challenging and very unpleasant to listen to and bothersome. But they win the prize because they're moving on some level.
And so need to be a part of the mix. Fair enough, Paul?
Yes, and I'd like to make a distinction between... I think that an ugly aesthetic can be quite beautiful. For example, The Rite of Spring is a pretty dissonant piece, and it's pretty ugly on some level, but it's stunningly beautiful. It's not pretty, but it's beautiful, and I'd like to make a distinction between the two.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Matthew, thanks for that. Let's go next to Nashville, and Zach's with us. Hi, Zach.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm a classical music student, undergraduate here in Nashville, Tennessee, and I actually just tuned in a few minutes ago. I'm driving on my way to class. And I just wanted to say how, you know, I think there's such a wide variety of new music out there. And I don't think, you know, I think people really need to be open, even if you hear one bad piece. For an example, I was, there's ugly music I've heard, but there's also one of my voice teachers recently did a recital in which she performed three very new pieces called a set of three art songs called Race for the Sky, which were written on three poems left at the World Trade Center Memorial. And it was just moving and lyrical and gorgeous and so heart-wrenching. And I think if people really open themselves to that, they can have such amazing experiences.
There's certainly something to be said for both narrative and the use of voice in modern music. And Paul, you bring quite a history of voice. You spent a lot of time in the choir. Do you draw on that now?
Sure. I was a choir boy in the Episcopal Church, which is probably the most formative experience musically for me. It's terrific training for kids, because you have to learn a couple of pieces every week and you have to get up and sing them. It's important to me in terms of, I think about a concert and I think about a musical performance and even listening on CD as a kind of secular ritual. I think it's very important. And I think that ultimately all instruments are extensions of the voice. The voice is the one instrument that's in all of us. We can all sing, however, you know, inadequately or adequately. We can all sing. And we all have this instrument inside of us. And when I think of what makes me make music, I think, well, what makes me sing? What do I want to sing about? For example, what is it in Shakespeare's play The Tempest that gives rise to song? And then I start to compose.
And when you're composing, are you doing it then by singing it out loud? Are you banging
Sometimes
on the piano?
Banging on the piano. I'm a very visceral, physical composer, as you might gather from listening to my music. It's quite, you know, it's physical. And I really need to sit at the piano and pound these things out.
Is that hard work, or is that the most fun you ever had?
It's just the most fun I ever had. I mean, composers are very, very lucky people. I mean, we have a hard time, a lot of us, making a living. But existentially, we are incredibly lucky people, because we are in touch 24 hours a day with a very great aesthetic pleasure. And there's just nothing like it. And when you are working on a piece, inventing something that has never been heard before, you're making something up out of thin air, as to quote Prospero in Tempest, you are, it's an enormously empowering.
God, and then to stand at the back of the concert hall and hear dozens of musicians concentrating all their professional training to making that real, that must be quite an experience as well.
It's absolutely astounding. I never get over it. It's a rush. I got to say.
Paul Moravec is my guest. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Let's go to Worcester, Mass. for our next call from Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Well, I have enjoyed this show, and I hope it represents a trend in American music. I'm a musician myself. I have an undergrad degree in music, and I like doing some composing, some arranging. I do some music teaching, and so occasionally I've had the opportunity to do some composing, and like you were talking about, it's a thrill to hear your own music composed. And mm-hmm. So I've had more of an interest in that lately, and I decided to look into some composition majors, some masters around the area. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity just a month ago to go into Boston to a school there and hear a representation of pieces by the composition faculty. And what hit me was, although I was very impressed with their ability to develop motifs and really to be very academic with the music, like you were saying earlier in the show, there was nothing that was left, no melody that was left with me. I was disappointed in that. And so I'm a little bit embarrassed to say I've not heard of Paul Moravec, but I certainly will be.
Well, you have now.
I have now. And I'll certainly be
you have no excuse now.
Can I, Tom, quick question for you. What kind of advice are you getting from people about the contemplating a career in composition? Can you make a living at this, or are there just like a handful of people who manage that? I'm going to ask you, and then Paul will jump in.
Yeah, I'm not really looking at making a living out of composition. I'm mainly pursuing it because I want to teach at a university level. And so I feel like it will give me a much more intimate understanding of music and give me the ability to teach more effectively in whether it's theory or orchestral direction, any sort of direction in music.
What about it, Paul? Could you make a living as a composer now? I mean, I know you're at Adelphi, but is there...
It's very difficult to make a living as a composer per se, and only that. Most of the pieces that I've written have been pro bono, so to speak. I mean, they've been, not commissions with pay. I've written them without money. Only recently have I been making actual real money, from commissions. It's a recent phenomenon. So it's a problem, but that's not why we do it. We're not in it for the money. We are in it for the spiritual satisfaction. I was interested to hear what Kinky Friedman said about using Gandhi's term, the coin of the spirit, which I think is a great phrase. This is why we do it. We do it for the coin of the spirit, ultimately. And we do what we need to and what we have to support our habit, so to speak. I teach at Adelphi University. I love it. I love teaching. Teaching is very much a part of what I do as a composer, because as a composer, I'm advocating certain ideas, and just as I am as a teacher. So,
you know, now from your work with the Tempest Fantasy that your name is forever carved in encyclopedias and other places where lists are kept. But the interesting thing about the work that you do is that the great measure of Paul Moravec will be taken after you die. It's how long does the music last after you die? Is that something that's frustrating, or do you kind of take a weird pleasure in that?
Well, there's nothing I can do about it. It's true. One thing that I bear in mind about, you're talking about what lives on in posterity and so on. I mean, what will go into the repertoire? I don't know. I mean, this is not for me to say, and I'm not done yet. I'm only, 47, so I have a long way to go, I hope. the point is that I think that works that enter the repertoire they're works that are loved and that are important to people and that people need to have in their lives somehow. It's not a luxury. Posterity is not kind. Posterity will take into the repertoire works that performers love and need to perform and that audiences love and need to listen to. And I hope that, of course, I'm in that category. That's an ideal I aspire to. But it's not for me to say, whether or not it's going to happen.
Of course. A little bit of Tempest Fantasy to help us close the program. And Paul, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Dick. I had a great time.
Paul Moravec, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer of Tempest Fantasy, which is playing in the background. I'll be quiet in just a minute so you can hear a little bit more of it. Thanks also to Terry Teachout, arts critic and author of All in the Dance is a Brief Life of George Balanchine. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We'll be right back.